So my project today is a fairly limited one. I'm trying to just say a little bit about the question of thermodynamics and limit concepts and the implications that this has for a larger program that I'm working on, a program of articulating and defending physicalism. So I'll say a bit about what I mean by physicalism and a little bit about how I understand emergence and the emergence of special sciences and special science properties in terms of the reduction of degrees of freedom of a system. We'll talk a little bit. I'll try to make that clear when we get there. And then we will talk a little bit. I'll discuss one particular example that philosophers have thought is particularly relevant to the question of emergence and reduction, namely that of the universal behavior of critical phenomena, phase transitions, and the way the renormalization group deals with this phenomenon. And I'll argue that, in fact, this is a good example of that it fits very nicely with my with the physicalist ontology as I envision it. That's supposed to have a your at the end of the heavy there, but there's liable to be some typographical issue. I'm thinking or, but I can understand if some people from elsewhere just disagree. But and then if we have time, and I don't expect that we will, but if I go more quickly than I expect to, maybe we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about the evidence for physicalism, why we should be physicalists, why we should believe that it's true, and even if we don't get to it, I'm happy to address those sort of questions in the question period afterwards. All right, so what is it that motivates the project? What's driving the physicalist urge that I feel, at least? Well, we've got one world that we live in, but we have all sorts of different descriptions. And the question that I think needs to be addressed is, what's the relation between these various descriptions that we have of this one single world? So what's the relationship between what's going on in our brain, for example, and what's going on when we talk about beliefs and desires and pains and feelings and those sorts of things? What's the relationship between individual organisms and populations or species? What's the relationship between hydrogen and oxygen and the water that we all drink and bathe in, et cetera, et cetera? What's the relationship between eclipses and planetary motion, freezing and molecular motion, et cetera, et cetera? Well, there's a obvious answer to this, and the obvious answer is that, well, there are certain emergent phenomena that we get at higher levels of complexity. But then we need to try to ask, okay, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to say that something emerges? What does it mean to say that something reduces? What would it mean to have a reduction of say, heat down to molecular motion, of have a reduction of water to H2O? And the issue is muddied by the fact that many different people use these terms in many different ways. Okay. So, in particular, I think it's helpful to distinguish the philosopher's concerns from the concerns that scientists often have, although the concerns will also often overlap. And so oftentimes when scientists are, see this fancy laser pointer thing, when scientists are talking about reduction or anti-reduction or emergence, what they will sometimes have in mind is that we have a reduction when we have some sort of property that is just involves linear combination, mere aggregation, etc. On the other hand, when we have a certain degree of complexity, a certain degree of non-linearity, we can't just consider the whole as a mere aggregate, but need to consider how the different parts are put together and how they're interacting, then this is an example of emergence in their language. Okay. A related notion is one in which the question of reduction versus anti-reduction or holism depends on what level of analysis or what level of properties or what level of phenomena are relevant to the particular process that you're interested in. And so this came out for me particularly saliently when I, together with Elisa, was teaching at a marine biological laboratory on Chesapeake Bay, and I was meeting all of these scientists who were, you know, well, the reductionists hated the holists, and the holists hated the reductionists, and they would sneer at each other's research and everything else. But then I was coming in as a philosopher and saying, well, you know, what do you mean by this? If you're not a reductionist, does that mean that you think that there's something non-physical going on or something along those lines? And they looked at me like I had three heads and said, what do you mean, something like magic or ghostly or something along those lines? No, that's not what we mean. And it took me a few months, actually, to try to figure out what it was that they were talking about. But it seems like what they had in mind here is the question of what is relevant to some particular process, some particular issue that we're trying to solve. And so if, for example, a whole bunch of fish are dying, right, the reductionist is going to try to explain that and resolve the issue by looking down at the chemical molecular level, try to figure out what actual molecular processes are being influenced by, are being disrupted and making the sick, the fish ill. On the other hand, the holists are going to be looking at the whole water or nitrogen cycle. They're going to be looking at the entire water basin of the Chesapeake Bay, for example, looking at how things are cycling through or being disrupted. So the question there is one of, well, okay, what features are relevant to try to explain what it is that we're interested in? But then we can ask the question, okay, well, are these sort of issues really important for trying to understand physicalism? And I guess I was going to say this on the next slide, but I'm going to go ahead and jump ahead and jump back. And what am I trying to capture with the notion of physicalism here? Well, I argue that we discovered something very interesting, something very important in the 20th century, something that people had guessed at before. A lot of people had believed that it was true, maybe even had good reasons to think it's true, but we didn't really know that it was true until the 20th century. Developmental quantum mechanics, figuring out the relationship between quantum mechanics and chemistry, the chemical basis underlying biology, etc. And what is it that we discovered is true? Well, what we discovered is that physicalism is true. So that's the insight, that's the truth that I'm trying to capture. What do we now know to be the case about our world that they didn't know in pre-Socratic times, that Descartes didn't really know, that they didn't even really know in the 19th century? And that truth is the truth that I'm trying to pin down, that I'm trying to articulate, and that is the truth of physicalism. Now, of course, in earlier days, people talked about materialism and materialism being true. But now we can ask the question, okay, well, you know, should we think that materialism is true? Well, what do we mean by matter, right? I mean, you know, is matter supposed to contrast with form? Is matter supposed to be purely geometrical the way that Descartes thought it was? Well, it looks like the electromagnetic field, gravitational field, these things aren't material in that sense, it turns out, right? But they obviously are still paradigmatically physical. And so the idea here is going to be that physicalism commits us to the claim that everything in the world is physical. So that's all well and good as far as it goes. But what does it mean to say that everything in the world is physical? Well, it's not enough to say that everything's just composed of microphysical entities. Because, of course, there were plenty of anti-physicalists who thought that biological things, for example, were composed of physical things, and yet they weren't completely, totally physical. Biology needed something else, some élan vital. It needed some sort of principles that could never be grounded in the physics in order to account for things. And that's what we want to deny with physicalism. So the general statement is that special sciences, special science properties, when we're talking about things like biology, when we're talking about things like chemistry, when we're talking about things like psychology, these things are nothing over and above the physical. Okay, but what does it mean to say that they are nothing over and above the physical? Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. Let me just sort of give some disclaimers before I give a more positive account. And the disclaimers is that I'm not necessarily going to insist on something that reductionist philosophers have traditionally insisted on in the past. I'm not going to insist on explanatory reduction. I'm not going to say that any time we have an explanation in terms of some higher level science, we can have an equally good or identical explanation in physical terms. I'm not going to insist on theory reduction, and I don't see my physicalism being an eliminativist materialism. That is, I don't want to say that there are no properties like redness or like liquidity or like heat or what have you. I think that what we want to say is that these properties are physical properties and understand them, but we don't want to say that sort of stuff doesn't exist and that we should be eliminating them when we recognize that everything in the world is physical. So how is this supposed to work? Well, here it's helpful to distinguish, as many people have, between a strong form of emergence and a weak form of emergence. And the strong form of emergence is what's going to be denied by physicalism. On the other hand, the weak form of emergence is something that is perfectly okay on the physicalist perspective and is what we're really trying to account for, what the physicalist ontology needs to make sense of. So the strong form of emergence is the sort of thing that the emergentists of the early 20th century, 19th century, and even before would have bought into. People who were arguing, for example, for vitalism or what have you. And this claim is going to be something along the lines of, well, physical laws, physical laws don't describe higher level processes. That is, the higher level processes like biology, these are accounted for by some biological force, biological principles. And this is going to imply that the laws of physics can't account for. Either the laws are violated or the domain of applicability of the laws of physics is not going to extend into the biological realm. Okay? So physicalism, as I understand it, rejects this claim of strong emergence. On the other hand, there is a weaker form of emergence that I think actually holds and that we want to understand. That weaker form of emergence says that there are higher level properties. But as a physicalist, I want to say those properties are going to be complex structural features of physical systems. And then we're going to want to try to understand what that means. So here's a thumbnail sketch of the ontology that I'm suggesting, of the account of physicalism that I think can make sense of things. And then my project is to go and look at higher level sciences, higher level kinds, especially problem areas, and see if it looks like we have any counterexamples to this, look to see whether this version of physicalism needs to be tweaked or whether it's just wrong or what have you. So the claim is that when we have increased complexity, when we have more and more constituents coming together and interacting, even in highly complex ways, that does not limit the accuracy of the microphysical description of the constituents, of the parts. Atoms are still going to behave, are still going to obey the laws of atomic physics, regardless of whether they compose a water in a bottle, regardless of whether they're running through our cells, regardless of whether they're out in the ocean, etc., etc. So this is the denial of strong emergence. The microphysical description is a complete description of the system in the sense that it has all the information about the actual particular system that is there. So this is going to imply that information about higher level properties, the information that's provided by the special sciences, this is not going to be additional information, but rather this can be thought of as a subset of the information or a repackaging of the information. Now, the ontology of information is not something that I'm really prepared to go into here. And so, if you're inclined to think that, well, repackaging of information is itself a new form of information, then I might need to modify this to be able to convince you, because there obviously is important repackaging, and we'll talk a little bit about this. And I take it that this is closely tied to the general claim that philosophers often invoke these days to thinking about physicalism, the claim that any high-level fact is going to supervene on the lower-level physical facts. What that means is that the lower-level physical facts are going to fix the higher-level facts. That there can't be a change in the facts about, let's say, biology without some alteration in the facts at the microphysical level. So if you've got two beings that are molecule for molecule identical to one another in exactly identical environments and what have you, it can't be the case that one is sick and the other one is healthy. Any sort of biological differences like that are going to have to be grounded in some sort of changes at the microphysical level. Okay, well, that's a general sketch. Let me try to give a little bit more detail of how I think this is going to work. And the way I think we can make a lot of sense of this is by appealing to the notion of a degree of freedom, which I'll talk about a little bit more in just a second. The basic idea, though, in overview, is just this, that the degrees of freedom of any system are fundamentally going to be physical degrees of freedom. Now, this is going, I'm going to argue, has a certain implication that it's not the case that the whole is able to do more than the parts are able to do. A common phrase that people throw around and subscribe to, the whole is more than the parts. You bring something together in a very complex, carefully organized sort of way, and now it is able to do something that the mere parts together are not able to do. I think that actually gets it backwards. I think that when we have complex entities, the kinds of special sciences, what makes them complex and what makes them be able to do the things that they can is that, in fact, they are restricted. They're not able to do things that they otherwise would have been able to do. And I'll try to make that somewhat plausible to you. But then the overall thesis is going to be that, okay, special science descriptions, the descriptions of special sciences, are made possible by reducing the effective number of degrees of freedom of a system, and restricting what it is that a system is able to do. So for those of you who know some physics, hopefully, you know, I'm in trouble if that didn't make sense to you. On the other hand, we've got people here for whom these are probably new terms. So let me try to just give a quick overview that will hopefully do justice to them, and talk about some concepts that are central to physics, but that philosophers have really so far not really made use of to try to understand the facts about emergence and reduction, etc. Unfortunate today that we've got the few exceptions or something like here also joining us for this session, and so but you're getting a skewed sample here. So here are some basic concepts. There are these intertwined notions: the notion of a system, the notion of a state space, the notion of dynamics, and the notion of a degree of freedom. That's DOF up here, is a degree of freedom. And these fit together, I think, in a definitional sort of way, such that a degree of freedom is some parameter, some variable that needs to have some value, and it needs to have that value to specify the state of a system. So the number of degrees of freedom of a system are the number of parameters that you need to assign values to specify the precise state of a system. Now, if you take the space of all of those possible states, put them all together, that's called a state space. That's a geometrical representation of all the possible states of a system. And then what physics does is it describes possible evolutions of the states in a state space. And so if you start out with your system in one state, has certain value of property for each degree of freedom, then the dynamics of the system will tell you how that system evolves through the state space. And the physical dynamics here are important both for telling you how that evolves, but it also plays a definitional role in specifying exactly what the state space of the system is. So just to give you an example to work with here, if we've just got a bunch of particles described by Hamiltonian physics, then for each one of the particles, you're going to have 1 degree of freedom for specifying the location of the particle. The x, y, and z coordinate saying where the particle is, then you're going to have 1 degree of freedom for each momentum coordinate saying how fast the thing is going in each of the three possible directions. That gives you 3 degrees of freedom for each particle. But then if you've got more than one particle, you've got to increase the dimensionality of your state space. So that way you've got 6 dimensions for each particle. So for n particles, your phase space is going to have 6 n dimensions. And then a state is just a point in that phase space that assigns a position and a momentum to each one of those particles. You solve the equations of motion, and that tells you how the state changes over time. That's physics. There you go. You didn't need to take all those classes and everything else. That's all physics does, okay? Not entirely true, but it's not that far from true either. Okay, well now let's talk about emergence, okay? And my claim is that emergence structure results from reducing the effective number of degrees of freedom. That is, the number of parameters that we need to consider, that we need to make sense of, to be able to understand the process that we're interested in, the behavior that we're interested in. And so what does this mean? Well, if this is right, then when we have, for an example, a molecule, well then what it's able to do is going to be less than what the atoms that compose it are able to do, because we've got a restriction in the number of ways that the things can be, which is what the state space, what the state space characterizes in terms of the various properties that the thing can have. And this is going to be true for higher levels as well. And so my idea here is that, well, look, if you are trying to build a rocket to go to the moon, right? A rocket is composed out of iron and nickel has all this hydrogen fuel, which is going to combine with oxygen, et cetera, right? And you might think, well, look, isn't it amazing that we were able to get all this stuff that by itself would never be able to get to the moon, that it doesn't have the ability to get to the moon, and we've been able to construct something new that is able to get to the moon? And while on the one hand I think that's true, I think what's more insightful is to appreciate that, in fact, the real difficulty of building a rocket is to try to prevent the rocket from doing all sorts of other things that it can do, specifically blow up, right? So you've got all these particles here, right? They can do all sorts of things. They can fly every which way willy-nilly. So what you've got to do is you've got to keep these things from doing all the other things that they can do to make it more likely that they actually will combine together and go up to the moon, right? So how do you reduce the number of degrees of freedom of a system? How do we get limited effective state spaces and dynamics emerging out of the full underlying physics? Okay. Well, this is the general problem of reduction. I think I say that someplace else later on, so we'll ignore it when we get there. That is, in each particular case, we're going to have to actually ask, okay, well, what's involved in building a rocket? How do we get the effective descriptions out from the underlying level? But I'm wondering, okay, can we characterize some just general sorts of ways that that effective lower dimensional state spaces emerge out of the higher dimensional, more complex state spaces underlying things? And I think we can. And I think that two of the most important ingredients here, and I'm wondering whether these are the only ingredients or if there are other characterizations or if there really is just sort of a plurality that we can't really characterize. This is something that I'm still sort of struggling with. But it's obvious, it seems pretty clear that there are at least two distinct ways that we can make certain degrees of freedom irrelevant. And one of these is by imposing constraints, and the other is by taking coarse graining or averaging or what have you. So constraints. constraints will make some fundamental degrees of freedom irrelevant. Okay, so the idea here is that if we've got many different particles, so you know, say we've got 10 particles, then that would mean that we would have a 60-dimensional phase space, right? We would need to specify 60 different distinct values of these numbers to say where each one of these 10 particles are. But if they are all bound together into some rigid structure, if they are constrained to keep the same distance relative to one another, then we no longer have to specify all 60 different parameters. Now the effective number of degrees of freedom is reduced. We can now just specify the center of mass of the object and the orientation of the object. And that's all that's relevant for the processes, for the dynamics that we have. So that's one kind of constraint that clearly is horribly important, wonderfully important. Choose your adverb here. I mean, think about the fact that we can talk about where this chair is, right? How many particles make this thing up? What's the underlying physical details that make all of this up? Well, I mean, you know, countless particles, etc., right? But we can talk about exactly where the thing is because these things are constrained into a single rigid body. And it seems pretty clear that the macroscopic world as we know and love it just would not be possible with this sort of, without this sort of constraint, without the production of rigidity and the regularity that comes with it. So that's one way to reduce degrees of freedom. Constraints. Another way that I don't think is really independent of the first way, but is clearly importantly different, is a kind of aggregation or averaging. And so for some processes, we don't need to know all the little details of things. We can just total everything together and then maybe take its average or what have you. And so, for example, we never would have come up with physics at all, perhaps, if it hadn't been the case that we don't need to know all the details of a planet like Mars and you know, the Sun or what have you, to be able to figure out the orbit of Mars around the Sun. All we really need to know, well, we don't even really need to know this, but the relevant parameters are just going to be the total mass. And we can then just treat the Sun and the planet as point particles, and then describe the physics of how they orbit around each other. So how is that possible? Well, because all the details of the configuration of the particles on Mars and the configuration of the particles on the Sun, etc., don't matter for the trajectory of Mars around the Sun. All that really matters is the total mass. It's insensitive to the organizational structure of the components. Well, that hopefully seems fairly clear. Now, one of the questions that I want to pose is the question of, do we have a similar sort of thing going on in thermodynamics, where we have some sort of aggregation of things? I think I'm going to jump ahead to talk about that, so that way we at least get to talk a little bit about the thermodynamics of things. Now, let me try to sketch a little bit here what sort of a simplistic picture of emergent properties, and to bring out some of the features that we expect emergent properties to have. So consider, for example, and Sam's here, so I need to, I guess he is actually, so I don't need to fess up. I came up with this example all by myself. That's Strominger across the river, actually, used this example to talk about emergence, and I think it's particularly vivid, to talk about the surface of an ocean. As you see it from a plane, you look down at the ocean and it just looks completely flat, that you could treat it from an airplane just as being a flat surface of a plane, right? But if you were farther out, further away, you would have to take into account the fact that it's not really flat, that you've got curvature. On the other hand, if you get closer into the ocean, well, you're not going to really be able to describe it as a plane anymore, because these things have, there's going to be waves on these things that are rising and falling. If you get closer yet, then the distinction between where there's water and where there's air itself becomes ambiguous and breaks down, because you've got air mixing into the water and water splashing up into the air. And, you know, at the molecular level, there isn't going to be a sharp divide between the two. So, whether how we use some properties is going to depend on the level of description that we're interested in. But it's important to recognize that it's not just our interest. This isn't subjective. But the what degree of coarseness is appropriate is going to depend on the particular process that we're interested in. So it's the world that is either going to be sensitive or insensitive to the details that we're leaving out. So when are these details going to be irrelevant? Well, there could be some situations for which you needed to have all the microphysical details to understand or to describe some process. But in practice, most processes don't care about the fundamental physical details. That's why physics is so expensive and so difficult. We need to have really high energy to discover new physics, particle accelerators, etc. We need to have amazingly sensitive detectors. On the other hand, if all we're interested in doing is heating up a room, well, you know, there's a million ways to do that, right? You can do it with forced air, with steam radiators, water radiators, et cetera, et cetera. The way of producing some sort of average temperature in the room is not something for which all of the microphysical details are going to be relevant. Now, the world then decides which details are relevant, and that makes it a scientific question whether details are relevant or not. And there is a particularly elegant science that has been developed looking at, in the case of something's critical behavior in particular, how it is that micro details become irrelevant for understanding certain behavior. So I'm going to talk briefly about this, and then we'll draw a few lessons. So what sort of behavior are we talking about here? Well, one of the astounding things is that when we're talking about critical behavior, there are lots of different systems that exhibit the very same sort of behavior, that the same physics comes out of it at the higher level. And so the example that we'll be talking about here is the transition from a gas to a liquid, the phase transition of a fluid. But you get the same physical story coming out of some a system that is completely different from this. For example, the case of a piece of iron transitioning from being a paramagnet, where it doesn't have any overall magnetic field, it's not going to attract anything, to it falling down and becoming, to its cooling off and becoming a ferromagnet, where these magnetic fields are going to be aligned with one another and it's actually going to attract something. Will we be hearing more about this later, or we'll hear a little bit more about this later, but I'm going to talk about liquid and vapor. And so, which, you know, as I'll point out, you end up getting the same sort of story. So what do we need to know to be able to understand this example? Well, I know none of us are surprised to hear that when you have a liquid like water, you get it really cold, it freezes. It's a solid. On the other hand, if you warm it up, it's a liquid. And if you get it even hotter yet, then it transitions into a gas, right? Well, specific behavior that we're going to be looking at is going to be the behavior when we take a gas at a particular temperature, and then we increase the pressure on the container, and that gas then will transition into a liquid if it's warm enough. On the other hand, if it's cold enough, the gas will transition into a solid. Now, there is a critical point here. And at this critical point of temperature and pressure, what this marks is, if we're at a temperature below this critical point, if things are cooler, then as you're increasing the pressure of the gas, there comes a point here where some of the molecules there in the container are going to be gas and some of them are going to be liquid. And so this is a coexistence region right here where you're going to have both gas and the liquid as you're in, as you are increasing the pressure. The triple point is amazing. It's one where you actually get a coexistence of the solid, liquid, and the gas phase all coexisting together in interaction in a single container. Okay. Above the critical point, on the other hand, you have a unique fluid phase, and you don't have any you don't have the same sort of coexistence of gas and liquid that you have below the critical point. So, what's interesting about this? Well, if you try to characterize the actual behavior of the system, what's going on here? And one way that you can do that is to try to look at, okay, well, you know, as I look at a the differences in temperature here, then how much difference is there between the density of the vapor and the density of the liquid that's present in this volume as the temperature changes, okay? And so as you've got a lower temperature here, there can be more of a difference between the vapor and the liquid here. But as you get closer and closer to the critical point, that vanishes until once you're beyond the critical point, then you no longer have the coexistence of liquid and vapor, and so then that just goes to zero. And so what people have been interested in is the shape of this curve. And this this curve then is an exponential, or rather a it's a power of the temperature here. And you can ask, okay, well, what's the value of that exponent that describes the shape of this curve? And so they've gone and seen what is the value of this exponent, and it's approximately 0.33. And the shocking, wonderful, glorious point here is that if you do this same thing for all sorts of different fluids, you get the exact same number. And you also get the exact same number even if you're considering the transition from of magnets from being from having an overall direction to their magnetic field to their being scrambled up and not having an overall direction. So this sort of critical behavior is universal, something that can be understood without taking into account what sort of thing you've got down there at the micro level. It seems to be a paradigm of emergent behavior. And so how should we understand this? Well, here's how it's explained. Normally, in thermodynamics, we can ignore any sort of long-range correlation between the molecules of things. We've got a gas in the room, we've got some water, the liquid and water, these things are going to be banging into one another, transferring energy from one particle to the other. But there's not going to be long-range systematic correlations among those interactions. And this then undergirds the claim that only aggregate properties are going to matter in most thermodynamic situations. And so if we're talking about, for example, the pressure of gas on some container, well, what we care about is, okay, well, how much momentum does the total of all these particles have as they're smashing against the wall of the container trying to push it out, right? Temperature, we're concerned with how much total or average energy do we have in the particular gas. But in the case of phase transition, behavior comes correlated. This is technically characterized by a parameter called correlation length, which then goes to infinity as you reach critical state. how do we this is then explained in terms of a renormalization group explanation. And here's a sketch of how that goes. What you do is you take the physical Hamiltonian that you're interested in, and you then simplify it. You coarse grain it. You reduce the number of components. You reduce the number of degrees of freedom, and you aggregate the interactions that they have between all of these different components. You do this in such a way that it retains the relevant form of the Hamiltonian, but you're changing the Hamiltonian through this transformation. What this does, then, is explicitly eliminates degrees of freedom from your description of the system. But that's okay, because those degrees of freedom are irrelevant to the behavior of the system as we're reaching the critical point. You run through this transformation again and again and again, getting a simpler and simpler and simpler description of the system. And then you find at the end of the day that you reach a Hamiltonian that only has the behavior that are relevant to the critical behavior. And then you can explain why it is that you've got things as diverse as water and magnets displaying the same critical behavior. You explain that by showing that their Hamiltonians will both reach this same sort of critically described Hamiltonian in the limit of repeated applications of the renormalization group parameter. Okay, so this looks like a particularly interesting, fascinating, problematic form of emergence. Is it problematic for the physicals? And I think that not really. In fact, it brings out some of the lessons that that I think are really important for understanding physicalism. The resulting properties that one gets after applying this renormalization group transformation are not distinct from the microphysical entities. Rather, it's just a restriction on the possibilities of the full underlying physical dynamics. Now, and so it seems to me that ontologically, this is a perfect example of what we should insist on if we're going to be physicalists. So ontological reduction, I think, actually holds, as I understand it. What about explanatory reduction? Well, it seems to me pretty clear that the renormalization group does provide a distinct higher-level explanatory framework. But notice that it wouldn't be okay to just go ahead and allow those explanations to the thermodynamic explanation, let's say, to sit there without asking how are they related to the underlying physical dynamics. We also require an explanation of how the higher level framework emerges from the microphysical facts. So the way I would characterize that is to say that what we have are distinct explanations, but we really shouldn't call the higher level explanation autonomous. But maybe there's more terminology there than substance. What do we mean by autonomous? All right, in conclusion then. So what are the implications of physicalism? I want to say that we can understand the ontology of physicalism by saying that all degrees of freedom are physical. Everything that happens is physical. It's grounded in the physical laws. And now we have entities that are accurately described by the special sciences. These things are never able to do anything that their parts are not able to do. The whole is able to do less than the structured sum of its parts, and this is what makes the special sciences possible. Now, there is a trivial sense in which this is obviously true insofar as, okay, well, if we put together all the parts into a chair or something like that, then obviously those parts can do what the chair is able to do, because that's what they're doing when they're put together in a chair. But I think that trivial sense is we're not just making that trivial claim, because we have an independent specification of what these things are able to do in terms of the physical laws. And I think the most important point for physicalism, what we discovered in the 20th century, is that the physical laws are indifferent to the complex structures of the whole. Thanks.